Joe Victoria, who will be at the pulpit today. Joe Victoria is a native of Seattle, Washington, and has been active in the East Shore UU in Bellevue, Washington, and the San Francisco and Redwood churches in California, and the UU Church of Eugene. Among other roles, Joe has served our denomination as a youth advisor, OWL teacher, PCD board member and president, and as a member of the WRSCC, which was part of the UUA's ministerial fellowship process. A fifth grade and middle school math and science teacher for the last 15 years, Joe is now teaching a second and third grade blend and happily living with spouse Eric in their funky mid-century modern Eugene home with their nephew and two bickering cats. Joe enjoys trips to the river and lakes, biking, home repair, riding, and avid, if ineptly, gardening.
A couple of years ago, I went to several days of training in which we developed a safe space with other teachers and school counselors, and we learned how to be facilitators of this thing called restorative justice circles. It was an incredibly powerful experience for me. It was full of conversation about creating safe spaces for youth in which they can talk about their experiences and their pain, in which we take the conflict that exists in schools out of a hierarchical system focused on punishment, and we put it into a system of creating right relationship. It's a powerful, amazing thing. Restorative justice's foundation is based on seven precepts. Many of the things that we all as Unitarian Universalists know well, the interdependence, the inherent value of all people. But two of the things in this training struck me and have changed how I teach and how I am in the world in some ways. And they definitely influence how I view the work I do with congregations. The first is a quotation from an explanation of one of the precepts. Quote, "It takes a sense of humility, realizing that each of us alone does not have all the answers, and a sense of gratitude for us to be open to the gifts that others bring." Humility. We are each but one part of the whole. We aren't the entire truth, but one piece of a greater truth. The second precept is a quotation that it was attributed to the Hopi people. Quote, "Gather yourselves. Banish the word struggle from your vocabulary. All that we must do must be done in a sacred manner and in celebration. We are the ones we have been waiting for." End quote. I am not here to give you answers. I am not here to give you truths. I am here as part of your ministerial search process to give you another part of the truth. I want to help you see how you are the ones you've been waiting for. I want to help you see that you have amongst you the answers and the pieces of the truth that you need. My role here today is to facilitate a process which will hopefully help you start more conversations in which you find more truth and more connection with each other and the world around you. I am here to remind you that we are all more powerful than we may feel and than we may seem. I am here to remind you that while it is easier to sit back and feel like we're done, we're welcoming, we're open, there's always more to do. And doing that can be joyful and celebratory, not a struggle. And I'm here to remind you that we are all in process. We are all still in the making. We're a project of our genetics, our experiences, and our intentions. We are powerful and wise and foolish and still figuring it out. And we have many names. Think for a moment about how you name yourself. What are some of the identities that you hold? mother, father, parent, friend, lawyer, teacher, waiter, white, black, Latino, Latina, Chinese American, leader, poor, middle class, student, athlete, nerd, secret lover of the late seasons of Project Runway. I know it's really kind of become a mess, but I still love it. Maybe you call yourself a survivor of abuse, of neglect, of divorce, of rape. Maybe you name yourself a woman or a man or a transgender. Gay, lesbian, bookish, and knitter, we are chock full of experiences and identities which are essential to who we are and how we look at our world. One of my key identities is that I'm a teacher. For the last 14 years, I've taught hundreds of elementary and middle school students with the wonders of science and the joys of math, my love of reading and my high expectations and poor sense of humor. It's an amazing job and I learn a lot. I am inspired by my students every day. I'm inspired by their stubbornness as they learn how to be a good friend, how to gain confidence in their abilities, as they learn how to stubbornly overcome obstacles, and as they get older, learn to find their adult identities. They haven't figured out yet that that identity is always evolving. Especially working with middle school kids, they are so earnest in trying to find out who they are, and they're always thinking they might have found the permanent one. And sometimes I have to hold my breath and go, because I can't say to them, they have to learn, there's no permanent about anything. Some of my students are not as immersed in that problem, and they have a good idea of who they are, at least in some level, but they haven't figured out how they're going to live with it and what it means about their lives. Some of them have identities that are or have been mine as well, though they don't always know it. I've had students who are children of immigrants, who are transgender, queer, nerdy, living with abuse or survivors of abuse, living with their own or the drug or alcohol abuse of others, who have a disability or are living or people who have disabilities or who are weirdos. I know there are images and memories that came to mind for you when I named those identities. Let them float around for a bit. Children of immigrants, transgender, queer, nerdy, survivor of abuse, former drug and alcohol abuser, living with a disability, weirdo. Some of the images you have might be kind of one-dimensional. Some of them might be more complex. All of what you think may exclude somebody who identifies in that way, inevitably, including me. I know I don't look like the current media image, but my parents were immigrants. They came to the United States with two young children, and I was the first American in my family. They were born with more inherent privilege than a lot of the students that I've taught, and I was born with more inherent privilege as well, as my parents came to this country with a work visa for my father, as my parents came here speaking English fluently because they are from England. They just had accents. As they came here with supportive family. People often look at me and don't think that I am the child of immigrants. I remember when I was in college a couple of decades ago, when the professor asked people who were immigrants to raise their hands and those who were children of immigrants to raise their hands. And I was one of the very few hands raised in a class full of students of color. And my professor looked at me and said, "Oh, I'm not taking questions right now." Oh. Despite all the clearly apparent work he's done on his own prejudices, he just couldn't look at me and think, immigrant, child of immigrant. But it's an important part of who I am, as is the fact that I'm transgender, queer, and nerdy, even through the very painful times of adolescent rejection, both by others and by myself. They're core parts of how I look at the world and always have. As is right now the fact that I'm getting over a cold. Also essential to how I see the world is that I am a survivor of childhood abuse, of adolescent rape, and of alcohol and drug abuse, both my own and of those I have loved and have loved. Even after so many years of the events and behaviors being in the past, they are part of me and how I see the world. My life experience gives me power in connecting with my students. The vast majority of my students in my classroom now, my second and third grade classroom in Eugene, Oregon, are not the children of immigrants as they were when I taught in Daly City. Most of them speak fluent English and have since they were children. Most of them have parents who are fluent English speakers. But my students are poor country kids. My students come to school without clothes that fit them, without full bellies. My students come to my classroom from homes of violence and disruption. And they come, they show up, they work hard, they try, and they are loved. My life experience is not their life experience, but it helps me help them and see them who they are beyond the poverty, beyond their family. But they live in a world that will attach to them identities. And all of us have had people do that, right? Somebody's looked at you and said, oh, I know exactly what you're like. Or you remind me of my uncle, so that's what I'm going to assume you do. Okay. People have walked up and said, oh, you look like you like to cook, right? I don't cook. I don't know why people think I cook. Okay. I can make a cake from scratch, but that's about all I do. We've all had people walk up and go, oh, you're, you know, or many of us, oh, you're X, you must be able to do Y, right? But when people do that, it can be awkward or uncomfortable, or it can hurt. And each of us have caused that harm to someone at some point in our life without even meaning to. Sorry, my nose. And each one of us have been harmed by that. There's really nothing I can do that my nose is dribbling, so I'm just going to stop being embarrassed. I can't control it. So I've been told in the past, because when you're a child of an abusive family, and that stays in this room, just so you know. Okay. But when you grow up with that life experience, people assume that you are a damaged person and that you walk through in constant pain, right? And people tell you, oh, forgive and forget. And I don't really do the forgive, forget thing because, honestly, if I forget, then I don't remember when it's helping me, right? Okay. If I forget hurt, then I can't prevent hurt from happening again. I can't stop myself from doing that same thing. So, okay. I'm kind of a understand and learn to live with it kind of person. So I try to understand that people who assume I'm a straight woman aren't trying to hurt me. I'm transgender. I prefer they, which is a singular, neutral, gender-neutral pronoun, or he, if that's more comfortable for you. I'm bisexual, even though I've been married to a man for a long time and love him with all my heart. I understand the people who assume that I'm being a trooper when I'm just doing my job, and that means I've got a cane or a knee walker or crutches. But I also don't ignore that it hurts. And it will hurt. And sometimes when you walk up to somebody and you say something, you don't know that there's hurt already there. I allow myself to feel that pain. But I also want to realize that for a guy who said, "What'd you do to yourself this time?" didn't know that he was the 10th person that day that assumed that I was using a cane or a walker because I was clumsy. Now, don't get me wrong, I still blurt out responses like, I was born with a disability, because I am just human. But I also am not going to walk away with that anger all the time. That's not my power. I'm going to call people on it, but I don't need to be angry at them when I do so. But that is me. And the thing to remember is that that anger, when it's directed at you, it may not be about just you. It's because you're the 10th person or the 100th person who's assumed that because somebody is Asian American, they know karate. Okay. And their anger at you is anger at a society that makes that assumption over and over again. It is a valid anger. It is an anger you're responsible for, even if you weren't trying. Because even when you're not intending to do harm, you will do harm. I think the most dangerous thing that we can do in this world is to forget to question those assumptions. And when we think we're done questioning. I think it's dangerous when we forget we're unfinished business. I tell my students a story, kind of an analogy for this that might help. I tell them that it's not okay to let assumptions lie and to not question things, because when we don't question them, we do harm. And so I tell them this, that if you hurt somebody in my classroom, you're responsible for hurting them, even if it's an accident. Just like if you had a stick over your shoulder and you walked around and you accidentally hit somebody with it. Is that person not hurt because you didn't mean to? You still caused the harm. That doesn't mean you're a terrible, horrible person who should be put in jail forever, which is second graders sometimes what they think. But it does mean that it's your responsibility to make sure that person's okay. Right? So as we walk through the world with the safety of our filters, we can do harm. What we need to do is remember we're still in process, that we're going to walk around and hurt people by accident. We're going need to remember and take responsibility for the fact that every one of us is capable of causing and regularly will cause harm. And we also need to question assumptions because we miss out. And that's why I'm here today. We assume people aren't interested in things. We assume people aren't us, aren't part of we. We assume people won't fit in or be comfortable. And what you're doing right now is you're looking for a new minister. And you want a successful ministry. It's kind of like dating. But just like on a dating profile kind of thing, if you automatically exclude a whole section of humanity, whether intentionally or not, you might be missing out on a life partner. If you forget to check your filters, you might miss out on the healthiest minister for this congregation. Not just in how you who you choose to call, but how you are with that minister. I'm here today because our denomination is determined to support you in finding the right minister for you. But I'm also here today because in our denomination, ministers of color, ministers who are transgender, ministers who have disabilities, and ministers who are bisexual have a harder time getting called to congregations and have shorter ministries. This is a fact. And they don't have a harder time being called because they're not a right fit for any congregation. They have a harder time being called because we assume that they won't fit in, that they won't be comfortable, that we're not ready for it. They also have shorter ministries, and they have shorter ministries not because they are not fitting in, but because we're expecting them to do the work for us. Your minister is not going to be your answer. Your minister is not going to be the bringer of truth. Your minister is not going to finish you, to make you perfect and complete. Your minister is not going to fix all your problems. Your answer is already here. You have the truth. You hold the truth. You don't need the minister to fix it. You can fix it. Your new minister is just a piece of the puzzle that is the congregation, just as your neighborhood is, just as your community is, and just as you are. I hope to be of use in this journey. I hope I have something to share this afternoon that you'll find useful. I hope to help you find some of that truth that is already within you. I hope to help you find a new way to struggle as we grow, as we continue to be unfinished business. May we work together and fail together and grow together today.